The singers Bruno Lima Rocha there talking to us from Porto Alegre, Brazil. Also activist and political commentator Ramiro Funes, who spoke to us from Los Angeles. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Miko Etahwe, entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories: a U.S. judge orders the partial disclosure of murder files of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a move hailed as a victory against, quote, the shameful U.S. cover-up of the killing. Number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in Europe tops 20 million. Also in the headlines, Turkey calls on the EU to act with common sense a day after the bloc threatened sanctions against Ankara over its dispute with Greece. Welcome. A U.S. judge orders the government to partially disclose files related to the 2018 murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. A federal New York judge has given the government 2 weeks to release documents it has withheld from the court and to provide legal justification for their non-disclosure. The human rights group Open Society Justice Initiative has hailed the ruling as a crucial victory in addressing the Donald Trump administration's, quote, shameful cover-up of Khashoggi's killing. The Washington Post columnist was killed and his body dismembered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul 2 years ago. The incident sparked international condemnations, with the CIA concluding that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the critic's murder. Investigative journalist Max Perry says there have been developments indicating the U.S. and Saudi Arabia might have colluded in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
The CIA and the administration have seemingly been at odds as to who they believe ordered the killing. You know, Langley has pointed the finger at MBS, while on the other hand, Trump has been very, very deliberately vague as to what the CIA's findings were. And I think that that probably has to do with the fact that we know that it was, you know, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who likely gave bin Salman the intelligence that the U.S. had on Mr. Khashoggi, including his travel logs leading up to the murder. And, you know, it's no coincidence here that in the last few months of the outgoing administration, Kushner has been traveling in the region to the Gulf state kingdoms, including a stop in Riyadh to visit the Crown Prince. You know, it leads one to think, what's going on here? Is he covering his tracks? Did he have a hand personally as a mole? And did he give the Saudis the green light to do this? I think this ruling shows how there are other factors at play going on.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will head to Brussels in an effort to clinch a post-Brexit trade deal with the European Union. Mr. Johnson is set to meet European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen later on Wednesday. The meeting follows months of talks deadlocked over several key issues, including fair competition. Johnson has called the current situation tricky. EU officials have urged London to make compromises, saying they will not accept a deal at any price. Both sides have spoken of a no-deal Brexit if no breakthrough is achieved. The UK left the EU in January. It's now in a transition period that expires at the end of the year. That is also the deadline for reaching a deal on future trade ties. Well, the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in Europe has surpassed the grim milestone of 20 million as the virus continues to take a heavy toll on the continent. Italy reported nearly 15,000 new cases in 24 hours, raising its caseload to date to more than 1.7 million. The country also recorded 634 new daily deaths, pushing the death toll to over 61,000 since the pandemic emerged in February. Turkey hit a record daily high as well in both infections and deaths, with the health ministry reporting 211 fatalities and over 33,000 cases. Europe's other hotspot, Britain, recorded more than 12,000 new cases and 616 deaths on Tuesday. Its total death toll now stands at over 62,000. Meanwhile, the Swiss government said it is preparing additional measures to restrict the spread of the virus amid worsening situation there. Well, just 10 months since the COVID-19 pandemic hit, the UK has begun to administer a vaccine. This is the beginning of a mass inoculation initiative that the whole world hopes will signal the beginning of the end of this pandemic. Bianca Rahimi has more.
Here in the UK, Margaret Keenan, who turns 91 next week, has received what she calls an early birthday present, the first of 800,000 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. She has been self-isolating alone since March and was pleased to get the jab.
I thought it was a joke, to tell you the truth, to start with. I couldn't believe it, you know, but I'm happy it's happened. And now I've done it, and hopefully it'll help other people come along.
At this initial phase, the elderly, vulnerable and NHS staff have been given priority. The effects of the vaccine are expected to kick in 12 days after administration, and Margaret and everyone else receiving the jab will have another dose in 3 weeks. Full immunity can be expected a month after the first dose. In the meantime, people are being asked to stick to the rules.
My message would be, it's amazing to see the vaccine coming out. It's amazing to see this tremendous shot in the arm for the entire nation, but we can't afford to relax now.
The scientists say life might start to go back to normal by April. The British government is touting this as a success for the United Kingdom, being the first to approve a vaccine. In an interview Tuesday morning, Health Secretary Matt Hancock broke down.
Just simple words there, reacting it. You're quite emotional by that.
Well, it's just, it's been such a tough year for so many people, and there's William Shakespeare putting it so simply for everybody that, you know, we can get on with our lives. And you know, there's still a few months to go. I've still got this worry that we can't blow it now, Piers. We've still got to get the vaccine to millions of people, and so we've got to keep sticking by the rules. But it's just, you know, there's so much work gone into this, and I'm really, really, it makes me proud to be British.
However, diminishing trust in the government has led to a lot of scepticism about the vaccine.
I think given the effects it's having, it's probably worth the risk. Not that I believe there is a risk, but I'd definitely be willing to take it.
Not right now. Do you know, it's too quickly. Like, the vaccine was made way too quickly for my own likings, and I don't think it's been tested well enough. And if it was possible to put a vaccine through this quickly, why haven't they done it before?
Because there's a pandemic going on around the world, and I don't think there's any conspiracy about it. And I've had vaccines when I was a little boy, and I'll take a vaccine now.
According to the largest survey of UK attitudes and behaviour during the pandemic, a fifth of people are likely to refuse a COVID vaccine. More than half believe that vaccines can cause unforeseen effects. And more than a third think natural immunity is better than immunity from vaccines.
Critical mass of people are going to have to get the vaccine in the coming weeks and months for it to work. The UK hasn't made it mandatory, so it might be a bit of an uphill job for the government to convince everyone that it is necessary and safe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the U.S. have surpassed the grim milestone of 15 million during the deadliest week of the outbreak since April. Seven-day moving average of new cases has also surpassed 200,000 for the first time. The coronavirus outbreak has so far claimed over 286,000 lives in the world's worst-hit nation. A record number of more than 100,000 coronavirus patients were also in the U.S. hospitals on Monday. Latest figures come as the country struggles to approve the emergency use of a vaccine. U.S. President Donald Trump has come under harsh criticism for his mishandling of the pandemic and downplaying public health measures to halt the virus from spreading. Political commentator Mr. Ian Williams says the COVID-19 pandemic has killed more Americans than all wars the country has been involved in combined due to the poor response from the Trump administration.
I think that by Christmas we're likely to surpass the combined casualty rates in the First, Second World Wars and every war that the U.S. has been involved in since, Vietnam and Korea. More people have died as a result of Donald Trump's incompetence and failure to act than all the rest of those wars put together. And, anybody would be hard-pressed, because this is a very successful virus. It's got all the characteristics to go on killing. It doesn't kill too quickly. It spreads easily. It's allowed to be transmitted. It keeps a lot of people alive and spreading the virus. So it's a very cunning virus, and it's meeting a very stupid opponent, unfortunately. It's going to carry on killing, even with the vaccine. There's going to be increasing death. But other countries have done it. Taiwan managed to choke it off at source. Hong Kong and Singapore managed to pretty much deal with it at source. China, whether or not it was the source, managed to choke it off. The one country, the most technologically sophisticated country in the world, we hear, with the best health service in the world, we hear, with the best doctors in the world, we hear, with the best pharma companies, we hear, hasn't managed to do it. It's managed to have a complete shambolic incompetence. There are areas that have tried to cope, the cities like New York and others, with a horrifying challenge, but they still can't do it alone, and the U.S. government has not helped. It's a completely incoherent response, and it's very American.
Now, Turkey has urged the European Union to play a role of an honest mediator in its deadlock over Greece, over Ankara's oil and gas exploration activities in the East Mediterranean.
We expect the EU to always act strategically and rationally. We expect it to contribute to the solution of existing problems. For this, the EU should play a role of an honest mediator.
In a joint press conference with its Hungarian counterpart, Çavuşoğlu, said Turkey seeks to improve ties with the bloc. He added that issues between the two sides can be resolved if the EU, quote, acts with common sense. His comments come a day after EU foreign ministers said they were considering sanctions against Ankara. The EU leaders are expected to discuss the issue in their Thursday meeting. Tensions escalated between Ankara and Athens in August after Turkey sent an exploration ship to the waters also claimed by Greece. Athens slammed the move as illegal and requested the EU to impose sanctions on Ankara.
The EU is set to decide on sanctions against Turkey over Eastern Mediterranean tensions this week. European Union final decision will take place on Thursday on the grounds of recommendations from the EU foreign ministers meeting. The EU has been involved in Ankara-Athens tensions for a while now, since Turkey sent a search vessel to a disputed area. This comes as Turkish president is seeking to push for dialogue between conflicting parties and countries of the Mediterranean, including North and South Cyprus, assuring that Turkey is only after what belongs to it.
We are not after exploiting anyone's rights, but are only taking a firm stance against pirates that try to take our rights away. All actors will be able to find a win-win solution when everyone acts consciously with common sense and sincerity.
Turkey and Greece have been at loggerheads over the Eastern Mediterranean underwater energy resources dispute. Ankara enraged Athens by sending a research vessel to a disputed area in August, and since then, Greece has been calling EU to take actions against Turkey. However, many say it is not easy for the EU to take actions against Turkey for several reasons, including refugee deal and economic relations between Ankara and the bloc.
There is a division inside the EU when it comes to Turkey. There is an alliance led by France that is pushing for sanctions against Turkey due to latest tensions with Greece. There is another alliance on the other side led by Germany that is trying to reach consensus on a solution for the conflict. So the EU remains divided and imposing sanctions on Turkey.
Turkey says it had already shown goodwill when retrieving Uruç Reis vessel and agreeing on dialogue without preconditions. Many here believe the EU will not take serious actions against Turkey and is only after pushing Turkey to stop its activities in the region until a solution is found. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Gunmen have attacked a military base in Afghanistan's eastern province of Ghazni. There have been no immediate reports of possible casualties. We are now joined by our correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alami, to get the details about that attack. Amin, over to you, please.
Well, this incident happened in Ghazni, the capital city of Ghazni province in southern Afghanistan. According to military sources there, two terrorists had planned to launch a twin-track bomb blasts on an Afghan army base in Mullah Nuh Baba area of this city in southern Afghanistan, but Afghan forces identified them and opened fire on them. As a result, the driver of one of the trucks that was full of explosives were killed, and his truck was also exploded, and the second driver was escaped. Afghan military sources both here in Kabul and in Ghazni province confirmed that at least five Afghan military forces were killed or wounded as a result of this incident that happened in the city of Ghazni. In the meantime, it was just a few days ago while the same city witnessed a huge same blast that happened inside a military base in Alilala area of the city of Ghazni. The incident happened after a Taliban attacker detonated a military vehicle full of explosives inside a military base of Afghan army in Alilala area. That incident also claimed the lives of dozens of Afghan military forces and wounded many other. Despite Afghan Ministry of Defense late on the day declared that Afghan military forces have launched a successful operation that has eliminated the mastermind of that attack on an Afghan army base in Ghazni, but the Taliban militant group claimed responsibility for that attack and said that the mastermind of that attack is safe and he has not been killed by Afghan military forces. Let's not forget that the Taliban militant group has expanded its attacks and bombings across Afghanistan and mainly on the city of Ghazni over the last months and particularly over the last weeks. According to Afghan Interior Ministry, over 2,000 Afghan civilians and Afghan military forces were killed or wounded as a result of the rise of bloodshed, violence, and Taliban attacks across the country. But now, why the Taliban are struggling to put further pressure or military pressure on the city of Ghazni in southern Afghanistan? The city of Ghazni is considered as one of the most strategic provinces or the cities of Afghanistan. It is located on the highway of Kabul-Kandahar that connects northern Afghanistan to southern parts of this country, mainly provinces of Wardak and Kabul, to the southern Kandahar, Helmand, and even eastern provinces. Another important factor regarding to the importance of Ghazni is that this province also has many borders with many other areas in central Afghanistan. And why central Afghanistan is important? Because most of Shia Hazara people are living in central Afghanistan, mainly in the provinces of Dainkondi, Bamiyan, and most of the districts of the same province, I mean Ghazni. Mm-hmm. It means that waging further war and violence and bloodshed across this province means that the Taliban is after opening a new way for themselves to enter to the central parts of Afghanistan. As we witnessed just 1 week ago, the most secure province of Afghanistan, Bamiyan, in central part of this country, witnessed twin blasts that also claimed the lives of dozens of civilians. That attack was a very huge attack and shocked not only the residents of Bamiyan but also politicians here. So that is why security analysts and military experts here urge the Afghan government to not only struggle to convince the Taliban on negotiation table, but also put further pressure, military pressure, on the militant group to stop them from entering the safe areas of this country.
Okay, many, many thanks. That's our man in Kabul, Amin Alami, with that update. Of course, we're awaiting more updates on the situation from there.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. Decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Donald Trump's attacks on Republican officials in Georgia and insistence his defeat by Joe Biden must be overturned are disgusting. Jeff Duncan, the Republican lieutenant governor of the southern state, said on Sunday, 6th of December. It's not American, Jeff Duncan told CNN's State of the Union program. It's not what democracy is all about, but it's reality right now. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Oliver Loughland and Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Trump's Attacks on Election Integrity Disgust Me, says senior Georgia Republican. Trump's attacks on Republican officials in Georgia and his insistence his defeat by Joe Biden must be overturned are disgusting. Jeff Duncan, the Republican lieutenant governor of the southern state of Georgia, said on Sunday, 6th of December. It's not American, Jeff Duncan told CNN's State of the Union program. It's not what democracy is all about, but it's reality right now. The president, Donald Trump, staged a rally in Valdosta, Georgia on Saturday night. He began his speech, which lasted more than 90 minutes, by falsely claiming he won the state, which in fact he lost by around 12,000 votes, in a result certified by Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger more than 2 weeks ago. They cheated and they rigged our presidential election, but we will still win it, Donald Trump falsely insisted. And they're going to try and rig the Senate election, too. Two Georgia Republicans face the 5th of January runoffs, which will decide control of the U.S. Senate. On Sunday evening, Kelly Loeffler will debate Reverend Raphael Warnock, her Democratic challenger. Amid controversy over stock trades made by both Republicans during the COVID-19 pandemic, Senator David Perdue has declined to debate his challenger, John Ossoff. In Valdosta, President Donald Trump invited David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler onto the stage. Neither reiterated his baseless claims about election fraud, Perdue coming closest by saying, "We're going to fight and win those seats and make sure that you get a fair and square deal in Georgia." As David Perdue spoke, the crowd chanted, "Fight for Trump." Some have suggested Donald Trump's assault on the presidential election could actually depress Republican turnout in the runoff elections in Georgia. "I think the rally last night was kind of a two-part message," Jeff Duncan told CNN. "The first part was very encouraging to listen to the president champion the conservative strategies of Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue and the importance of them being reelected. The second message was concerning to me. I worry that fanning the flames around misinformation puts us in a negative position with regards to the 5th of January runoff. The mountains of misinformation are not helping the process, they're only hurting it. CNN's Jake Tapper then asked Jeff Duncan, "At a certain point, does this disgust you?" "Oh, absolutely it disgusts me," Duncan said. In Valdosta, Donald Trump read from a prepared list of nonsensical evidence he said highlighted his victory in the election. This included arguing that by winning Ohio and Florida, he had in fact won the entire election. And also that winning an uncontested Republican primary was proof that he beat Joe Biden in November. Donald Trump lost the Electoral College 306 to 232 and trails in the popular vote by more than 7 million votes. His campaign has launched legal challenges in various states. The majority of those legal challenges have been rejected or dropped. The campaign filed a new lawsuit in Georgia last Friday. Trump vented his fury at Republican Governor of Georgia Brian Kemp, a one-time ally who he called from the White House on Saturday to demand that Georgia result be overturned. "Your governor could stop it very easily if he knew what the hell he was doing," Trump told his supporters, adding, "For whatever reason, your Secretary of State and your governor are afraid of Stacey Abrams." Stacey Abrams, a staunch voting rights advocate who Brian Kemp beat for governor in 2018, helped drive the turnout and secure the state for Joe Biden, the first Democrat to win Georgia since 1992. Sunday, Jeff Duncan was asked if Brian Kemp would do as Donald Trump asks and call a special session of the state General Assembly to appoint its own electors for Donald Trump, a demand one critic called shockingly undemocratic. "I absolutely believe that to be the case, that the governor is not going to call us into a special session," Jeff Duncan said. In an angry intervention earlier this week, Georgia election official Gabriel Sterling said of Trump's attack on Kemp, Raffensperger, and other Republicans, "Someone's going to get hurt, someone's going to get shot, someone's going to get killed, and it's not right, it has all gone too far." Jeff Duncan said, "We've all of us, got increased security around us and our families, but we're going to continue to do our jobs." Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, Brad Raffensperger, and myself, all three voted and campaigned for the president, but unfortunately he didn't win the state of Georgia. Jeff Duncan sidestepped a question about the wisdom of holding a rally where many attendees did not wear a face mask, as coronavirus cases have surged. But he did call Joe Biden's request that Americans wear face masks for 100 days absolutely a great step in the right direction. On Saturday, the Washington Post found that only 27 of the 249 congressional Republicans were willing to acknowledge Joe Biden's election victory. Duncan did so. On 20th of January, Joe Biden's going to be sworn in as the 46th President of the United States, and the Constitution is still in place, Duncan said. "This is still America, and a Lieutenant Governor, and as a Georgian, I'm proud that we're able to look up after three recounts and be able to see that this election was fair." Brad Raffensperger told ABC's This Week program, "We don't see anything that would overturn the will of the people here in Georgia." It was sad but true, he added, that Donald Trump had lost the election. "I wish he would have won. I'm a conservative Republican and I'm disappointed, but those are the results." In Valdosta, Georgia, Trump did seem at some point to recognize that the end is near. With reference to policy of China, he described what we would have done in the next 4 years. He also said that if he thought he had lost the election, he would be a very gracious loser. "I'd go to Florida," he said, "and I'd take it easy."
are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
My name's Amina Taylor, and we are broadcasting from London. So we start with what's being dubbed V-Day. Just 10 months since the COVID-19 pandemic hit, a vaccine is being administered outside a clinical trial here in the United Kingdom. Now, this is the beginning of a mass inoculation initiative that Britain and indeed the whole world hope will signal the beginning of the end of this pandemic. But has the government built enough trust with the public? Bianca Rahimi finds out in this report.
Here in the UK, Margaret Keenan, who turns 91 next week, has received what she calls an early birthday present, the first of 800,000 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. She has been self-isolating alone since March and was pleased to get the jab.
I thought it was a joke, to tell you the truth, to start with. I couldn't believe it, you know, but I'm happy it's happened, and now I've done it, and hopefully it'll help other people come along.
At this initial phase, the elderly, vulnerable and NHS staff have been given priority. The effects of the vaccine are expected to kick in 12 days after administration, and Margaret and everyone else receiving the jab will have another dose in 3 weeks. Full immunity can be expected a month after the first dose. In the meantime, people are being asked to stick to the rules.
My message would be, it's amazing to see the vaccine coming out. It's amazing to see this tremendous shot in the arm for the entire nation. But we can't afford to relax now.
The scientists say life might start to go back to normal by April. The British government is touting this as a success for the United Kingdom, being the first to approve a vaccine. In an interview Tuesday morning, Health Secretary Matt Hancock broke down.
Just simple words there, reacting it. You're quite emotional about that.
Well, it's just, it's been such a tough year for so many people, and there's William Shakespeare putting it so simply for everybody that, you know, we can get on with our lives, and you know, there's still a few months to go. I've still got this worry that we can't blow it now, Piers. We've still got to get the vaccine to millions of people, and so we've got to keep sticking by the rules, but it's just, you know, there's so much work gone into this, and I'm really, really, it makes me proud to be British.
However, diminishing trust in the government has led to a lot of scepticism about the vaccine.
I think given the effects it's having, it's probably worth the risk. Not that I believe there is a risk, but I'd definitely be willing to take it.
Not right now. Do you know, it's too quickly, like the vaccine was made way too quickly for my own likings, and I don't think it's been tested well enough. And if it was possible to put a vaccine through this quickly, why haven't they done it before?
Because there's a pandemic going on around the world, and I don't think there's any conspiracy about it. And I've had vaccines when I was a little boy, and I'll take a vaccine now.
According to the largest survey of UK attitudes and behaviour during the pandemic, a fifth of people are likely to refuse a COVID vaccine. More than half believe that vaccines can cause unforeseen effects. And more than a third think natural immunity is better than immunity from vaccines. Critical mass of people are going to have to get the vaccine in the coming weeks and months for it to work. The UK hasn't made it mandatory, so it might be a bit of an uphill job for the government to convince everyone that it is necessary and safe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Well, Lembit Opik, the former MP and political commentator, is with us. And Lembit, as somebody who perhaps is still feeling the impact of COVID that you contracted just a couple weeks ago, Pfizer has been given legal protection by the government. Does that make you feel a little bit more easy in the mind?
First of all, I wish this vaccine had existed 2 months ago so that I could avoid the worst November I've had in decades. I'm recovering from the disease now, and there's no doubt if we have a successful vaccine, that's great. My concern is the one that's been expressed in your piece there. There's always going to be a risk if you rush something which is biologically significant to the human body, that you have unforeseen side effects, unforeseen circumstances which cause other problems. Now, what's the balance here? In reality, I think it's probably better that they do this. But let's recognize there's a political dimension here as well. Britain wanted to be the first in the world to implement the vaccine. They've achieved that with 800,000 vaccines being rolled out now. But there is still that small risk. I think it's probably a risk worth taking.
Now, of course, they won't be mandatory at the moment, but things like traveling and other essential elements of life might require a vaccine passport. What are your thoughts on that?
In the short term, it makes sense if you want to limit the impact not just of people coming into the United Kingdom with the disease, but also people going from the United Kingdom, which is a very high disease risk area in terms of the world at the moment, so that we don't spread it to other countries. So in that sense, having a vaccine passport makes sense. But once again, I'm concerned about the long-term implications here. Britons have given away a lot of freedom, voluntarily by and large, because they've been good corporate citizens, they've wanted to prevent death. But these precedents, if they become rather more restrictive, we could end up in a country where we have biological authoritarianism, where the vaccines become mandatory, you can't travel if you haven't got one. Then we begin to have a civil liberties debate, not one for tonight, but it's one we will certainly return to if this is used as a precedent outside this pandemic.
So will a beleaguered Boris Johnson be breathing a bit easier tonight, Lembit?
He will be, but he ought to be a bit careful here. A recent YouGov poll puts him at having 34% approval ratings and 58% against him. His party is level pegging with the Labour Party, very close together. He needs this to work. The truth is, Amina, that if this vaccine shows a massive decline in the disease, he'll get the benefit from that. But it's also, in some ways, a junk bond. The value of his credibility can go down as well as up. And if there is some terrible byproduct of this, which causes different infections, then he'll get hurt by it. He's had to put all his eggs in this basket. The country didn't want to go into 2021 with no hope. But frankly, his political fortunes are probably absolutely intimately connected with the success of this and the other vaccines. That means he's actually handed his future to pharmaceuticals.
Indeed, Lembit Opik, thank you, as always. Now we move on to the European Union, where they've rejected the results of Venezuela's parliamentary elections. This saw the President Nicolas Maduro's political alliance win some 67% of the seats. More than 14,000 candidates representing 100 or so political parties took part in the election, despite opposition parties, including U.S.-backed Juan Guaido, the former leader of the National Assembly, boycotting the vote. Now, the statement falls in line of that of Washington's. They've also rejected the elections, despite no attempt to concur with international regulators and observers. Western powers are keen to overthrow the socialist government of Nicolas Maduro and have attempted 3 unsuccessful coups in the past year. Now with us, Isaac Bigio, the political commentator. He's with here for his reactions. Isaac, hi. You surprised by the EU stance here and that it so clearly mirrors that of Washington?
Well, because the European Union has been following what the United States is doing, and perhaps one person can think, oh, now we are seeing that Donald Trump is accusing his own system as fraudulent, and that even Chavez, after being dead, has been able to manipulate the results against him, that the European Union could change. They didn't change. The same day as Venezuela had elections, Romania had elections, and they also had one-third of electors to participate. So the same as Venezuela, but they don't criticize Romania, they only criticize Venezuela. Some European elections have less participation than in Venezuela. Most of the local elections in the United Kingdom and many parliamentarian by-elections have one-third or less of participation, but they don't accuse that of fraudulent. In the Venezuelan election, we have more than 100 parties, most of them from the opposition. You mm-hmm. have different right-wing opposition and even a left-wing opposition. But I think that the European Union is always going to follow what Washington says.
And very briefly on this one, Isaac, the U.S., we know, has directly backed multiple coups in just the matter of the last 18 months or so. How can they talk about free and fair polls?
Have you seen Donald Trump accusing his own system as fraudulent? The United States has supported every single dictatorship in Latin America in the last 70 years. None of them has been punished by the Organization of American States. But in Venezuela, they removed the Venezuela from the Organization of American States. They recognized Guaido, a guy that had never been elected by anybody. He couldn't stand in this election because he was not going to have any single vote. In Catalonia, they rejected a referendum organized by the Catalan government.
Indeed.
Despite that 40% of the population vote. But now in Venezuela, they reject a national election and they wanted to implement a referendum which nobody is going to vote. I think that is a double standard. When they want somebody to be punished because this government is against the United States,
indeed,
they will punish the government. It is a government that for the United States, they will follow that route.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you, as always. Now we move on to Britain here, where the country's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has labelled the latest rounds of Brexit talks as difficult, further adding that the UK would have to decide very soon if there was indeed going to be a no-deal Brexit. With just over 3 weeks before Britain completes its journey out of the bloc, significant differences still remain over trade, state aid and fisheries. And if an agreement is not reached by the 31st of December, the UK and the EU could introduce import charges on each other's goods. Prime Minister Johnson's comments comes just a day after he and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen spoke on the phone and agreed significant differences on key issues remained. The pair have scheduled to meet in person in the next, quote, coming days.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Richard Sudan, Priti Patel, Britain's Home Secretary. Well, is she covering herself in some more glory there?
Well, I mean, we're learning now, Amina, just days after the UK Home Office and Priti Patel went ahead with a number of deportations. The deportees, we believe, were directly related to the Windrush family. Of course, that was a scandal in itself, erupting 2 years ago. And now, just days after this, we find that the Home Office is set for another round of deportations of potential asylum seekers. And invariably, this has raised massive concerns to human rights lawyers and also watchdogs, who are saying that, you know, the government is going to come out with their usual line saying these people must be deported for X, Y, and Z. But experts are actually saying there are potentially people targeted by this move who themselves have been victims of trafficking, human trafficking, and other serious crimes, and they need to have their case further looked at before this decision can be made. In some ways, this doesn't surprise us, but of course, you know, we've become used to this kind of move from the Home Office, but human rights campaigners are understandably furious at the proposals, Amina.
And has this sentiment been reflected in the online reaction?
It certainly has. A lot of people keeping ahead of this issue now. John Brady says, I see Priti Patel is rushing the deportation of asylum seekers to beat the Brexit deadline. This includes people suspected to have been trafficked into the UK. This is the same Priti Patel who said, let the Irish starve during discussions on the impact of Brexit on food supplies. And we have a reaction from Andrea who says, men and women in Brexit Britain are unjustly detained and unlawfully deported. Windrush children suffer the deportation of their parents. The ethical and moral fabric of this country is deteriorating under government threats.
Well, I guess that's what they meant when they say take back control. To your other story now, unfortunately, Richard, whenever we speak, there seems to be just another tragedy. This time, once more, coming out of the United States and the killing of another unarmed black man.
Another day and another black man dead at the hands of law enforcement, Amina. This time, 23-year-old Casey Goodson, who was shot in Ohio on Friday. Now, almost predictably, the police allege in their account of events that Casey Goodson was holding a gun. But get this, Amina. Casey's own family say he wasn't holding a gun. He was holding a sandwich, and he was actually shot 3 times in the back whilst entering his own home. Front of his grandmother and also a sibling, you know, a child. And, you know, quite apart from the fact that Casey Goodson has had his life taken from him, I can't really imagine the trauma this would have sparked with his family. It's an almost unbelievable state of events. There's been a lot of celebration in recent weeks, you know, at the back of Donald Trump, as if this is the back of racism. But I mean,
we're clearly seeing that that's not the case at the moment, or perhaps it's just intensifying feelings in these volatile weeks before the inauguration. Can we move on to the social media reaction on this, Rich?
Sure, let's go to Stance Grounded, who says, Ohio police killed a 23-year-old black man who was walking into his own home with a Subway sandwich. Casey Goodson Jr., the police claim he was waving a gun, but he had a concealed carry license and the police shot him in the back. And Moonzy, also on Twitter, says, his name is Casey Goodson. He was just 23 and he was unjustly taken from his family and from the world. We demand that Franklin County Sheriff's Office takes charge and arrests Deputy Jason Mead and put him under trial for murder. We will not rest until we see justice.
We might have some bad news for Moonzy here, which in many of these cases, the officer is not charged. All right, Richard Sudan, we'll leave it there for the moment. Thank you so much. So some other news now, where EU foreign ministers have begun evaluating grounds for sanctions against Turkey over its claims to hydrocarbon resources in the Eastern Mediterranean. The EU's bloc's leaders will decide at a summit later on in the week on whether to make good on these waves of sanctions. Speaking on the East Med dispute, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Turkey would not bow to threats and blackmail from the EU over its row with Greece. The president added that any plans or maps excluding Ankara from its rights in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea were unacceptable. NATO member and EU candidate, Turkey claims gas resources that are also contested by Greece and Cyprus, a dispute that has had spawned territorial rows over maritime borders. Now, French President Emmanuel Macron announced that concerns over human rights violations in Egypt would not affect the future sale of French arms to that country. Since 2015, France has sold considerable amounts of weapons to Egypt, with Macron voicing concerns that the country would turn to the West's rival, China and Russia, if it did not receive adequate support from Europe. Following Macron's press conference, over 20 human rights groups issued a statement condemning France's strategic partnership with Egypt. The statement accused the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, of human rights abuses in the country, including the cracking down of pro-democracy activists and supporters of his rival, Mohamed Morsi. Well, it seems a Saudi prince is breaking ranks when it comes to the occupation entity. Robert in Lakesh, more details, please.
Well, this is an interesting case, and it can be read in many different ways. So the statements which were made by the prince, the Saudi prince, Turki al-Faisal, of course, these are very accurate claims. He says that it's a Western colonizing power and that it operates concentration camps for Palestinians and it assassinates whoever it wants. These, are, of course, ring true to many's ears, but unfortunately, we're looking at Saudi Arabia here, which does a very similar thing in Yemen. It's a close ally of the West and, of course, Israel. We know of the first meeting officially, which just occurred between the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Netanyahu, and also Secretary of State for the United States, Mike Pompeo. What may have happened here, it could be taken a few different ways. Number one is that it looks like Saudi Arabia are quite enraged at the fact that Netanyahu leaked the fact that this secret meeting was supposed to be secret meeting Saudi Arabia, for one. They're not quite yet ready to normalize ties with Israel. And so perhaps this is sort of pulling away from them, and it's a way of them, you know, signaling that it's not time for them to normalize ties, that they're not ready to go ahead with this. It might be a saving face thing also. And on top of that as well, people have speculated as to whether this is something to do with Iran. Do they want to be seen as such an aggressive party against Iran on the front lines for Israel? Do the Saudis want to subject themselves to possible retaliatory strikes on Saudi Arabia if they formalize ties with Israel and start allowing Israel to even use their territory to commit massacres against Iran and to strike Iranian territory? Do they want to get tangled up in that? And of course, perhaps they do not want to get tangled up in such a thing. So this can be taken many different ways. But of course,
Robert in Lakesh, there could be the idea here that there's not a uniformity of positions inside the House of Saud, that there are actually members of the royal family who thinks this is a bad idea for a variety of reasons.
Absolutely. There is a difference of opinion. Even with the UAE normalization, there's many that were against it that just didn't voice their opinions. We've heard one of the opinions voiced here. And so it does show there's a divide in opinion here. However, Saudi Arabia continues, for instance, to crack down on Palestinians, behead Palestinians, imprison Palestinians for no good reason, of course, and crack down on the Hamas movement and put out false statements about the Hamas movement. So, you know, one Saudi prince stating
that. To this one,
well, the first one we've got here is from a user called David. He says he's basically saying he says all of these things while sitting at the table at a panel with Gabi Ashkenazi, who's the foreign minister for Israel. And he says, lol. And we've got another one here from an Israeli who says they will never settle with the Jewish state, maybe only for a short time when it suits their interests and if it's not public. I posted previously a photo proof of their anti-Israel training seminars, and that's interesting because, of course, there's many in Saudi Arabia that disapprove of this, and the Israelis are not friendly towards them on a general level.
And we move to your second story. Some interesting words coming out of Brussels for Tehran.
Absolutely. This one, just utter hypocrisy, trying to paint, you know, the JCPOA as an agreement where it's just a an ask and deliver sort of negotiation here. They want Iran basically to hold up their side of the JCPOA when all the other sides have betrayed it. The United States unilaterally withdrew from it. Trump then slapped on these criminal sanctions, which amount to war crimes in some cases against Iran. And the Europeans have not held up their side of the bargain. And they have not gone as far as even attempting to punish Israel, not only for the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, Iran's top scientist, but on top of that, Qasem Soleimani as well. Nothing has been done on the international stage for this. Whilst they're still doing weapons deals, for instance, with Saudi Arabia, with the Persian Gulf states, on, you know, unprecedented levels, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons flooding into that region. And they have the audacity to criticize Iran. Many are saying this is ridiculous. Israel has a stockpile of, it's estimated, about 300 nuclear weapons. They haven't signed the non-proliferation agreement. Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program, and it's enriching uranium for other purposes. It's stated as such. There's no one, no body on earth which will state that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. And, of course, it's utter hypocrisy. Why wouldn't Iran even be able to obtain such a thing if it wanted to attain such a thing, for instance? This is just...
And some very powerful responses to this claim.
The first one we have here is from Sayed Mohammed Marandi, who says, in an interview on CNN, I stress that Iran won't accept any changes to the nuclear deal. Nothing will be added or renegotiated. The report implies that this is a bluster. This is a dangerous Western miscalculation. Iran didn't resist 4 years of Trump's barbarism to appease Biden. And then we have another one here that says, fool me once, shame on you, fool me, shame on me. Why should Iran waste time, effort to entertain a one-sided deal only from for another few terms of seesaw political pantomime that ushers in another U.S. patsy that reneges on a deal lauded by honest Western nations? No thanks.
All right, Robert Inlakesh, thank you, as always. And this is where we leave you for this evening. Until next time, stay safe.